Catholic Family Podcast presents Lent Around the World, daily traditional Catholic meditations read by our friends from across the globe.
The Passion and Death of Our Lord Jesus Christ by the Most Reverend Alban Goodyear. Chapter 10, Part 29, The Way of the Cross. The battle was over, the enemy had won, and nothing now remained but that the execution should be carried out as quickly as might be. He of whom it had been said, before he was yet born, that he would sit on the throne of David his father, and that of his kingdom there would be no end, was about to be put to death. He whose life as an infant Herod the Great had failed to destroy, who had openly defied the lesser Herod, saying he would die where and when he would, was at last at the mercy of his murderers. He whom at Nazareth, at Capernaum, then in Jerusalem, men had planned to annihilate and had failed, now at length was delivered into their hands. They had wished to cast him down from the mountain, and he had passed through their midst. They had taken up stones to stone him, and he had gone out of their sight. They had sent guards to take him, and the guards had returned empty-handed. They had plotted and devised schemes, and yet he had come in and gone out as he would, and no one had dared to lay a hand upon him. Now he stood before them, on the steps between them and Pilate, to the Jews a block of stumbling, to the Gentiles foolishness, not only helpless to resist, but almost seeming that he would not resist even if he were able. He was to be led as a lamb to the slaughter. He would not open his mouth. The guilt of the world was upon him, and he would carry it. The sentence had been passed by his Father, by himself, and by man. It was for him now to complete the greatest act of love that man has ever done, for man or for God, upon this earth. There were other executions appointed for that day, for executions were common on the eve of a great feast. Jesus, then, need not be sent back to prison to await another day. He could be put to death at once with the other criminals. One more in the group would be of no account. There was little time left for further mockery or insult. The sanction had been gained, his blood was already upon the accusers and their children, and a silence of dread determination fell upon the crowd. Indeed, from now till he is actually raised upon the cross, we hear no more of cries and accusation. The task is hurried through without a further word. Even the evangelists themselves catch the spirit of the scene and pause only twice in their story. All this time, Jesus had stood before the people as he had left the hands of the Roman soldiers. The red robe of mockery still covered his shoulders. The helmet of thorns was still upon his head. The cords were still about his wrists. The blood flowed down his face, hiding it like a veil. Now these things were torn once more from his body, opening the dried wounds afresh. His own clothing was brought up from the barrack yard, and meekly he covered himself with it. In this he should traverse, for the last time, the streets of his beloved city. As he went along, it should be known without a doubt to every onlooker who was the criminal that was going to receive the reward that was his due. It was Jesus of Nazareth, the Jesus whom many knew, whom, till that moment, many had professed to revere. Who would reverence him now? They took him down the steps from the balcony where he had stood all this time by the side of Pilate. The governor's work was done, and he could retire to his next diversion. Israel had no further use for the despicable Gentile. At the foot of the steps, executioners were waiting, holding the wooden beams to which the condemned man was destined to be nailed. The beams were put upon his shoulders, the bed on which he was to die. Meekly, he put his arms about them, he pressed them to him, for they were to be his standard through the ages. 2 years before, not far from that very spot, he had stood over a begging cripple and had bid him arise and take up his bed and walk. In that very street, his deed had roused a controversy. He had saved others. Himself, he refused to save. There was no delay. The usual procession was formed, the herald leading, the Roman guard with the prisoners in their midst, the crowd making way, pinned against the walls of the narrow street. And bearing his own cross, he went forth to the place which is called Calvary, but in Hebrew, Golgotha. From Fort Antonia to the Knoll of Calvary, the distance was barely half a mile. The route wound in and out among the narrow lanes across the north of the city, almost due west from the house of Pilate, creeping first along the northern wall of the temple, dropping down into the Teropian Valley, then up again by a street of many steps and through the bazaar towards the Tower of David. At ordinary times, it was at most a walk of a quarter of an hour. With Jesus in his present plight, weakened by the loss of blood and with the weight of the wood upon his shoulders, it may well have been a little more. As the procession moved through the crowded streets, the rest of the city went about its ordinary business. It was the eve of the Paschal Sabbath, and preparations of all kinds had to be made. Many pilgrims from abroad filled every quarter, and the sellers of food, the money changers, the dealers, and whatever might attract a stranger's notice could not lose the opportunity. There were droves of animals being brought into the temple from the country. Altogether, this was not a day on which much interest would be taken by ordinary people in such a thing as a common execution. Not even the attendance of so many priests and elders would avail to attract them. As he looked at them lazily and unconcernedly from his booth or counter, many a squatting shopkeeper would tell himself, with a hidden sneer, though his face remained a blank, that here was another victim of these merciless men, this time being hounded to death. Some would ask their neighbors, who was this man who was evidently so hated? And they would be told that he was one who had called the scribes and Pharisees a wicked and adulterous generation, who had cried woe upon them for their injustice and hypocrisy, who had said that their power would be taken from them and would be given to another. This was he who had called himself the light of the world, the good shepherd, the life of men, the Son of God, who, it was true, had done nothing but good, but who had claimed for himself such rights and titles as no scribe or Pharisee could tolerate. He had been accused of perverting the nation, of stirring up the people, of making all the world go after him. The Roman governor had condemned him for making himself a king. Such men were better out of the way. They disturbed the peace. They interrupted trade. Commercial Jerusalem had its own working creed. It had little use for fanatics or bigots. So we may be sure the talk passed from mouth to mouth as the procession moved through the streets. It turned into the main thoroughfare, which came into the city by the Damascus Gate. How often had Jesus come to and gone from Jerusalem by that route? It was the ordinary road from Nazareth through Samaria and the Judean upland. When he had come annually to the temple, when he had gone through Samaria to Cana and had met the woman at the well of Jacob, when he had returned for the great assault upon the city at the Feast of Tabernacles the year before, he had come and gone by that gate and road. It had memories for him now, not least the memory of her who, 20 years before, had passed down that street searching for him that first time a sword had pierced her heart. Tradition says that it was at the corner of this street that she met him on his way to Calvary. Now at last the end had come, the end which she had always known must come, and which she had seen always hanging over him in the cave at Bethlehem, in the home at Nazareth, in the marketplace of Capernaum. Beyond this thoroughfare, the route turned to the right, and a narrow street of many steps had to be climbed, leading up to the thickly populated portion of the city and the bazaar. At the foot of this ascent, there was a pause. The officers of the law looked at their prisoner. In his broken condition, with the weight of the wood lying heavy on him, they might well wonder whether he would be able to climb the many steps of the street unaided. The danger must not be risked. Jesus must be given help to carry his cross. But who should help him? Not one of themselves. Rather let him die on the road than that a Roman soldier should relieve him. Not one of the following crowd. To have asked or compelled a Judean to assist a criminal would have put him to lasting shame. As they hesitated, perhaps as Jesus lay upon the ground gathering strength for the ascent, it chanced that there came down the road from the Damascus gate one who by his dress was clearly no Judean. Evidently, he was a stranger from abroad, come no doubt like so many others for the festival. He was seized and examined. He was a native of Cyrene, that was in North Africa, beyond Egypt, beyond Alexandria, far enough away to save him from losing caste. He would serve the purpose. Let him help the prisoner with his burden. Simon of Cyrene resisted, as well he might, but the elders and soldiers were not men to be contradicted. They forced the wood upon his shoulders and bade him to follow Jesus up the hill. At first he was crushed with the shame. He was indignant beyond words. The very stones beneath his feet seemed to echo words flung by Jesus at his enemies only a few days before. They bind heavy and insupportable burdens and lay them on men's shoulders, but with a finger of their own they will not move them. But soon there came another refrain. This man whom Simon was assisting was not one to be outdone in generosity. Never had anyone helped him, but he had received more in return. Never had a grace been accepted from him, but another had instantly followed. Whether Simon knew it or not, this man had said winning things to those who would share his burdens. Take my yoke upon you, he had said, and learn of me, because I am meek and humble of heart, and you shall find rest for your souls. For my yoke is sweet and my burden light. So he had enticed men to follow, and when they came and would be his men, it was by the same standard that he chose to test them. If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. He that taketh not up his cross and followeth me is not worthy of me. Whosoever does not carry his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. By these words alone, we may judge what passed through the mind of Simon of Cyrene. Jesus was one who kept his word. He turned sorrow into joy. Not only was his burden light, it became a glory. Long afterwards, when the story of the Passion was retold, the sons of Simon of Cyrene, Alexander and Rufus, were proud to recall the favor that had been done to their father by Jesus the Lord that day. And as they led him away, they found a man of Cyrene named Simon, the father of Alexander and of Rufus, who passed by coming from the country. Him they forced to take up his cross to carry after Jesus. But there were many others in Jerusalem that Paschal season of whom something must be said. The Gospel of St. John, which alone tells at length the story of Jesus in Jerusalem, is and is intended to be by the evangelist for the most part a record of rejection. Nevertheless, it contains abundant proofs that among the people of the city and of the whole province of Judea, there were very many who in their hearts, some even openly, believed in him. What do we? For behold, all the world goes after him, the elders had said on a memorable occasion, and we have seen how they feared to hasten his capture or to take him openly, lest perhaps a tumult arise among the people. There were those of an older and faithful generation, represented by Zachary and Elizabeth, by Simeon and Anna, in the early days, good and earnest, far-seeing and long-suffering souls, who continued to wait for the consolation of Israel, and indeed knew that it had come. There were many, not of the humbler classes only, exploited by the Pharisaic rulers, as Jesus himself had said in his memorable denunciation of them, who departed not from the temple by fastings and prayers serving night and day. There were the faithful followers of John the Baptist, who under his direction had transferred their allegiance from their beloved John to Jesus. And many resorted to him, and they said, John indeed did no sign, but all things whatsoever John said of this man were true, and many believed in him. There were those who had been influenced by his miracles, especially the two great miracles in Jerusalem itself, the healing of the beggar at the pool of Bethesda in the north of the city, and the healing of the man born blind at the pool of Siloe in the south. But of the people many believed in him and said, when the Christ cometh, Shall he do more miracles than those which this man doth? And again, these are not the words of one that hath a devil. Can a devil open the eyes of the blind? There were the crowds who had taken his side in the many disputes in the temple court, especially during the last days, who had risked the displeasure of the priests in so doing, and yet whose numbers had made the priests afraid. Of the multitude, therefore, when they heard these words of his, some said, "This is the prophet indeed." Others said, "This is the Christ." To whose conclusions the Pharisees were only able to retort, "This multitude that knoweth not the law are accursed." There were men of higher station, such as Nicodemus and his friends, or such as Gamaliel and his school, who followed in secret and were not few in number. However, many of the chief men also believed in him, but because of the Pharisees they did not confess him, that they might not be cast out of the synagogue. And besides those dwellers in Jerusalem, there were also at this time many more who had come into the city from elsewhere for the Pasch, from Galilee, from Perea, where he had never been unfavorably received, even from Syria and beyond, who had gone long journeys to Jesus in Capernaum, and had learnt to believe in him and love him and follow him, no matter what his enemies might say. To many of these, the news of the events of Thursday night had quickly spread. If on the occasion of a lesser feast he had been looked for and had been missed when he had failed to come, now that he was known to be in the city, he was not for long out of their sight. On the Friday morning, what had been done and what was being done was soon made known to them all. He in whom they had believed apparently had failed. He was in his enemies' hands and was being done to death. If the apostles were scandalized in him that day, much more were these poor people who knew no better. They had seen no transfiguration. They had heard no prophecies of the Passion. The bread of life had not yet been given to them. They had still to wait before they knew of the coming of the Holy Spirit. And yet, not all. If many, like the apostles, feared and remained in hiding, waiting for the turn of events, there were many more who had no such fears. These were drawn to Jesus now as they had been drawn to him before. They had loved him in life more than they had known, and now love drove them to follow him that they might see the end. As the procession passed through the narrow streets, the accompanying crowd had been forced to stand back and follow after. They came to a crossing of two streets. It was not far from the end of the journey. There a large group had gathered, awaiting him. No sooner did he appear than loud lamentations broke out. For indeed, what an end was this to all their expectations! What a doom for one whom they had learnt to take for their ideal! Was this he of whom the Baptist had said, "There shall come one mightier than I, the latchet of whose shoes I am not worthy to stoop down and loose. He shall baptize you with the Holy Ghost and with fire, whose fan is in his hand, and he will purge his floor, and will gather the wheat into his barn. But the chaff he will burn with unquenchable fire." Was this he whom John had pointed out to them, saying, "Behold the Lamb of God, behold him who taketh away the sins of the world," whom John had boldly defended before he himself was struck? "He must increase, but I must decrease. He that cometh from above is above all." So these poor followers, who had known the Baptist by the Jordan, argued among themselves. But there were others from Galilee who remembered the happy days when the fame of him went out through the whole country, and he taught in their synagogues and was magnified by all. When men cried, "What word is this? For with power and authority he commandeth the unclean spirits, and they go out." And the fame of him was published into every place of the country. When his wonder-working brought back to their minds the words of the prophet, "He took our infirmities and bore our diseases," they remembered the time when they lost him and sought for him and found him alone in prayer on the mountainside. And the multitude sought him and came unto him, and they stayed him, that he should not depart from them. When, again, he could not openly go into the city, but was without in desert places, and they flocked to him from all sides. They recalled that evening in the cottage at Capernaum, when he had first forgiven sins and had proved his right by a miracle. And all were astonished, and they glorified God, saying, "We have seen wonderful things today." They could not forget that other time when his enemies had first laid definite plots to catch him, when he had gone away from Capernaum, but they had followed, and they had recalled to themselves the prophecy, "Behold thy servant whom I have chosen, my beloved, in whom my soul hath been well pleased. I will put my spirit upon him, and he shall show judgment to the Gentiles. He shall not contend nor cry out, neither shall any man hear his voice in the streets. The bruised reed he shall not break, and the smoking flax he shall not extinguish, till he send forth judgment unto victory, and in his name the Gentiles shall hope." This was he who had taught them on the mountainside as no other had taught them, the blessedness of poverty, the blessedness of mourning, the blessedness of persecution. And it came to pass when Jesus had fully ended these words, the people were in admiration at his doctrine, for he was teaching them as one having power, and not as the scribes and Pharisees. This was he whom they had proclaimed outside the gate of Nain, "A great prophet is risen up among us, and God hath visited his people." And again, on the green plain beyond the lake, at the paschal season of last year, "This is of a truth the prophet that is to come into the world." These memories, and many more like them, were still fresh both in Judea and Galilee when Jesus came back from his exile in Syria in the latter days. And a sudden collapse such as they were witnessing that day could not immediately destroy them. Indeed, it revealed to them something new within themselves, which they had not realized before. In the past, they had been won by this wonder worker, this prophet who spoke as no other man spoke, this man fit to be their king. They had put their faith in him, and even when they saw him in this plight, they would not take it back. They had admired him, they had acclaimed him, but not till now had they discovered how he had found his way into their hearts. Now the glamour was all gone. The tongue, it seemed, was silenced forever. The wonder-working power was paralyzed. He whom they had wished to make their king was on his way to death with that title held before him for his shame. Still was he Jesus Christ. Though stripped of all, he was still their Jesus of Nazareth. Now in his sorrow, they discovered what they had never discovered in the days that all went well, how much they loved him. To see him in this plight was an agony, but also it was a fascination. They crowded towards him as he passed. The sight of him drew from them sympathy that refused to be restrained. Even the Roman guard could only yield to such a tide of sorrow. And there followed him a great multitude of people and of women who bewailed and lamented him. Jesus, bent beneath his load, saw and heard this gathering of friends and sympathizers, and the effect on him was characteristic. It was in keeping with all we have known of him before. If he could not pass a weeping widow, but he must do something to console her, neither could he pass by mourning such as this without a word. If many a time he had shown pity for a devoted multitude because it was as a flock of sheep without a shepherd, how could he but feel pity for this flock whose shepherd was so sorely struck? Whatever might befall himself, he must think of them. Such had always been his nature, never more manifest than during these hours of agony, insult, and injustice. In the garden one had betrayed him, and he had pleaded to the traitor as to a friend. When the mob had seized him, he had thought first of his own and had secured them from harm. In the house of Caiaphas, he had thought of his judges before all else and had warned them of the judgment that would come to them because of all that they were doing. When the apostle denied him, Jesus, turning, looked on Peter, thinking more of unhappy Simon Peter than of the injury done to himself. In the house of Pilate, he had regarded only the Roman governor, warning him, instructing him, drawing him, finding excuse for him, till the judge himself had been disconcerted. Before this weeping multitude, it was the same. Even at such a moment, whatever cruelty might be shown to him, there was the same gentle courtesy which he had often shown to women in distress, to the widow of Nain, to the woman who was a sinner at Magdala, to the woman who touched him in the crowd by the landing place at Capernaum, to the wife of Jairus, to the Syrophoenician woman at the coastland by Tyre,
to the women taken in adultery in Jerusalem, to the two beloved sisters in Bethania. There was the same ignoring of himself, no matter what he suffered, as he thought of the suffering that was theirs, both present and to come. Moreover, what he said to these mourners was couched in language worthy of one who spoke as no man spoke. It was the mystic language of the prophets of old, the colored language of the poets, as if the very suffering he underwent did but sharpen the more the keenness of his vision and his power to express it. Saints have dwelt upon the dignity of Jesus throughout the Passion, in spite of all that was done to him, though he was crushed till he seemed a worm and no man. Never does that dignity appear more than at this moment. It was their reward who mourned for him. In the future years they should bear this portrait of him stamped upon their souls. He stood still in the road, commanding again when he would, however the Roman guard and the pressing enemy might urge the procession to go forward. He looked upon these weeping women and these silent men. He looked from them into the future. There he saw other women weeping in these selfsame streets, in misery so great that this world has hardly seen the like. Twice at least before, during this very week, he had warned Jerusalem of the doom that awaited it because of its rejection of him, and each time it had been not in the language of an angry avenger, but in that of one who loved the very stones of the city of his choice. When others had gloried, he had only wept. When others had sung Hosanna to the Son of David, he had only stood where David himself had once stood, an exile from his own city, and said, If thou hadst known, and that in this thy day, the things that are to thy peace, but now they are hidden from thy eyes. For the day shall come upon thee, and thy enemies shall cast a trench about thee, and compass thee round, and straiten thee on every side, and beat thee flat to the ground. And they shall not leave in thee a stone upon a stone, because thou hast not known the time of thy visitation. On the Tuesday following, when at last he had been driven to pronounce woe upon the scribes and Pharisees, love made him end with the cry to the very walls of his beloved city. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them that are sent to thee, how often would I have gathered together thy children, as the hen doth gather her chickens under her wings, and thou wouldst not. Behold, your house shall be left to you desolate. Before that day of doom came, he had bidden his own flee from the city. Now he spoke to these women with his thoughts occupied with them alone. If he thought of himself, he thought only of the sorrow that must come to others because of the injury done to him. But Jesus, turning to them, said, Daughters of Jerusalem, weep not over me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the day shall come wherein they shall say, Blessed are the barren, and the wombs that have not borne, and the breasts that have not given suck. Then shall they begin to say to the mountains, Fall upon us, and to the hills, cover us. For if in the green wood they do these things, what shall be done in the dry? So beautifully, even in the midst of all this day of horror, could Jesus Christ, the Son of Man, both think and speak. It was no strange thing. The story is not extravagant. It was Jesus Christ as we have always seen him, as he is to the end of time. As we have already noted, a strange dullness, almost a silence, seems to have come over the story of the Passion at this point. Since the procession left the house of Pilate, we have heard nothing of the cries of the pursuing crowd. Simon the Cyrenian could easily be picked up in the street in spite of it. Jesus himself, in spite of the guard about him, could easily be reached by the multitude of mourners on the road. It would almost seem that the mob, with its leaders, exhausted with all they had done that morning, had vanished for the moment, to appear again when their victim was secure on the cross. Indeed, this may well have been so. The cortege made its way through the crowded streets of the bazaar to the place of execution outside the city wall in the northwestern corner. In the vanguard, the soldiers pushed the people aside. In the center, the three condemned to die carried their burdens, of interest to very few. The seekers of blood followed in the rear, too eager to reach their goal to hinder the proceedings by too much confusion. As they watched the procession move along, now for the first time, the evangelist tells us that two other malefactors were being taken to die along with their Lord. They speak of it as nothing extraordinary. As we have already seen, executions were commonly fixed for the eve of festivals, and these men, not improbably with Barabbas in their midst, would have been crucified that day, whether Jesus had been with them or not. His condemnation had not hastened theirs. Nowhere is there any hint of this, either in the narrative itself or in the later charges hurled by the criminals against him. According to the agreement between Pilate and the priests, Jesus had only taken the place of another, the Son of God, in the room of Barabba, the Son of the Father. It may be noticed that when the release of Barabbas was demanded, then for the first time the cry, "Crucify him," was heard. One other event only, on the way to Calvary, the evangelists consider worthy of mention. It was a common custom to give some stupefying drink to one about to be crucified. A sympathizer on the road might offer it, or the executioners themselves, less out of sympathy, more that the cruel nailing might be more easily performed. A victim half stupefied would be less able to resist or shrink. We are told that a drink of this kind was offered to Jesus. He took it, touched it with his lips, but did no more. To do thus much was to show his gratitude to one who did him this passing kindness. But the only chalice of which he would now drink was that which his Father had given him. And they gave him to drink wine mingled with myrrh. And when he had tasted, he would not drink.